From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Flint, Michigan, when a University of Rochester graduate went home. Alexandria Brown graduated in 2018 and then went home to the Flint region with a purpose. She wanted to tell the stories of how Flint residents were dealing with the many challenges facing them. As the University of Rochester Alumni Gazette tells it, Zander began writing for two local publications, Flint Side and Flint Beat, and there was plenty to do. Flint became national news with its water crisis and the 2014 decision by city leaders to provide water from the highly polluted Flint River. The Michigan Civil Rights Commission later decided that what happened in Flint was not a one-off. It was consistent with decades of systemic racism. Zander Brown decided that her journalism could be done through the lens of what is known as solutions journalism. She wanted to be part of how the region could improve and fix the many underlying issues. She hadn't necessarily grown up planning to be a journalist, and her own family might have been surprised at her environmental concern. After all, as the Gazette reports, Zander's conservative family scoffed at what they thought of as tree huggers. But a lot has changed for Zander. With her education and experience, Zander is using photography and the written word, for starters, to try to impact the world around her. My guest for the hour is Zander Brown, a journalist based in Flint, Michigan, U of R grad. Zander, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
So I want to talk a little bit about your background growing up in the Flint suburbs, and then we'll walk through your path into the work that you're doing now. And I think a lot of our listeners will be very keen to hear what is actually happening in Flint and, you know, sort of what the update on the crisis is there. But you grew up in the Flint suburbs as a, you say, a bookish child?
Yeah, I was definitely reading a lot. Education was a big deal in my household.
What was the reading list for you growing up?
I think growing up, it was a lot of the classics. So I was reading a lot of Jane Austen, a lot of the Bronte sisters, Dickens. I had a tutor who would come to my home, Miss Webb, and she would, you know, give me a reading list of like all the classics and stuff like that. So yeah, that would take up a lot of my time.
And you arrive at the University of Rochester thinking, well, I mean, it sounds to me like you kind of grew up thinking maybe literature, maybe history, English, you know, what did you figure your major would be?
Oh man. I definitely was inclined to English, but for a while there, I was like, okay, maybe anthropology. I was kind of like a little all over the place. I thought at one point I was going to be a medievalist because I was taking a lot of medieval English courses. but yeah, I definitely was within the English range and settled with English and history.
Where were you when you first heard about the Flint water crisis?
Okay, yeah. So as the Gazette probably says, like I was pretty disconnected from a lot of the stirrings of what was going on back home. I was completely kind of encompassed within university life. And I just remember like there was a point where my friends had kind of brought it up first to me, like, hey, have you been tuning in like about the water crisis? And I was like, what water crisis? Like, I really didn't have a sense of what was going on at all. Considering that most of my core family was stationed in the suburbs. So, and a lot of my external family was still living in Flint, but I wasn't getting that news.
And you were probably, I guess that would have been around your freshman year, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, freshman and sophomore. Mm-hmm.
And how did that sort of unfold for you, trying not only to keep up with that news, but to understand how it might be impacting people you knew back in Flint?
Yeah, I think my thought process was, again, I still felt very remote from it all. I think me taking the classes that I was taking, which we'll probably touch on later with environmental humanities, I think made me think a little harder about it. It just kind of seemed a little surreal. And it's kind of like a weird phenomena when a place is your home and a place where you grew up in, you're not really, it's almost like the consequences are a little dulled, you know? And when I was even living back home, like I did attend a lot of the schools in Flint, but they are privatized schools. And I talk about how you kind of grow up with this kind of like soundproof environment in which you're not like you're in the community, but you're not of the community. So these things are kind of like rain droplets off of like a duck's feather, you know, so to speak. And you're not really feeling like what that news is and what those impacts are.
That is a really interesting way to describe the way communities can be sort of disconnected, even when there isn't a whole lot of mileage in between, whether it's a city in its suburbs or even family members living in different places. Do you find that to be the case in Rochester as well?
Yeah, I definitely felt that way as like a university student. But as I continue to look around me and ground myself in where I was, which I think university was a good practice in being able to do that, which followed me when I returned home. You just look at what's in front of you and like looking that like most of the, you know, the staff that's, you know, supporting the food and the transportation, you know, when I was a Gandhi fellow, I actually did a project that focused on that and looking at the Rochesterians that were the nuts and bolts of keeping the university running and in good shape are people that are of the greater community. And although there had been efforts and a lot of talks and tension because, you know, there was a thing about arming the public safety officers, confusing of students with community members and what that really means and what those undertones are. You know, I did see that a lot and kind of how the university is built with a bridge, you know, and, you know, the efforts of like delineating who's community and who's a student, you know, those can be really tough conversations to have.
Yeah. And even, I guess, a city in its suburbs, right? Whether it's Flint, Michigan, Rochester, New York, a city in its suburbs can be very close together in terms of geography and yet very far apart in terms of how people are living and what people even sort of are aware of.
Yes, world of difference. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Talking to Xander Brown, who's a journalist based in Flint, Michigan, attended the University of Rochester. So tell listeners what your major ended up being.
So my major, I ended up double majoring in history and comms with a minor in environmental humanities. And I definitely think the minor was the one that really hit the score for me in terms of what I wanted to do.
So environmental humanities is the term for the minor. And for someone like yourself who ends up on that path, people might assume that, well, you grew up doing a lot of camping, doing a lot of outdoor stuff. Mm-hmm. Instead, that the Gazette writes that your conservative family was not into tree hugging. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a family with a vast array of ideologies, which I appreciate because it's allowed me to approach people of various backgrounds and have an open mind. But certainly, I think that, and it's definitely more complex when it comes to Black conservatives. You know, there hasn't been a large volume of conversation about that, but, you know, it's definitely more complex in the ways that Black people relate to nature and how we see ourselves oriented towards, quote unquote, nature. So, you know, it was just seeing kind of like environmentalism as a, you know, quote unquote, liberal agenda, whatever that might mean. And using the environment as an excuse to, you know, stop the progress of business, whatever that might mean. You know, a lot of just jargony stuff that anybody can see on the spectrum of Fox News or even MSNBC or various other media platforms.
Did you feel that way too? Did you think, oh, you know, those hippie tree huggers, you know, they're just trying to stop business progress?
Yeah, I mean, as a young person, as a young conservative, and also just growing up in a mostly white environment, yeah, I think I was definitely more prone to accept that. Like, I might not have understood fully of what that meant, but to regurgitate it, yeah, certainly. Certainly, for sure.
And there's another aspect of this that's interesting that the University Gazette touched on, and I'd like to quote from that now. It's a question of faith and the environment. And the Gazette reports, quote, "As someone raised in a fundamentalist evangelical Christian household, Brown says her experiences as a university student shifted her perspective dramatically. Her religious instruction had taught her that the earth existed for human use. Her environmental humanities classes altered her view." So we'll talk about environmental humanities in a moment here, but let's stay with what sort of evangelical Christianity meant for you and your family growing up from the environmental perspective. How did that sort of mix together the notion of an environment for human use, particularly from a religious perspective?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to evangelical fundamentalist teaching, like I was specifically Baptist, you take the Bible literally, so word for word, what is written is true, right? If the earth is created in 7 days, it's created in 7 days. If, you know, Adam was responsible for naming the animals, Adam was responsible for naming the animals, you know what I mean? So in that respect, it really posits humankind as a sole author of, and a sole, I would say, not composer, but director of how nature proceeds. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really thinking about it in depth. It's kind of like whatever happens is supposed to, you know, happen. Like, you know, man impacts nature, and then it's not really the other way around in which how nature impacts human beings. You know, if something is supposed to happen, if something exists for use or to perpetuate, and we do it as human beings, and, you know, that is what we do. That is the will of the universe, you know?
Well,
essentially.
Yeah, your story got me thinking about a person in the climate science movement who has a new book out, which I have not picked up. It is brand new. I'm going to grab it and invite this climate scientist on the program. But the book is called Saving Us. It's by Catherine Hayhoe, who is a climate scientist and also an evangelical Christian. And her book is expressly designed to communicate environmental urgency across political and social divides. And Hayhoe now routinely talks about her own evangelical faith and why that makes her more concerned about climate change, not less. Here's what The New Yorker wrote about her in a recent profile. Quote, Hayhoe is the climate ambassador to the World Evangelical Alliance, and much of her work involves helping fellow Christians mobilize their churches. There is a long history within evangelicalism of advocating creation care, the belief that God charged humanity with caring for the earth. The Evangelical Environmental Network, which Hayhoe advises, argues that evangelicals should follow a biblical mandate to care for all creation. And Cal DeWitt, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has long advocated that pastors call their congregations to earth stewardship. But Hayhoe believes that emphasizing the care of plants and animals is less effective than highlighting the potential dangers for our fellow human beings. It is not about saving the planet, she said. It's about saving us. And that's the name of her new book, end quote. Let me just start by asking, what do you make of Catherine Hayhoe's call to evangelical Christians like herself that the climate crisis is something that should be central for them?
Yeah, no, I think her position in, you know, kind of pivoting the stewardship narrative found within the Bible to bringing it even deeper home to like feeling for your fellow man. I think that's really revolutionary and super important. I think that's something that probably a lot of Christians, if, you know, depending on who they are, think deeper about. It's something that they can relate to. I would be definitely interested to see how she addresses sometimes some religious apathy, to kind of go into that more of like, how does she go into the perspective that a lot of Christians have, which is like, people make choices and they say that it's God's will and they leave it up to quote unquote God, and, you know, that they're not in the world, they're not of the world, you know, and really that the true prize is heaven. So how, I'd be interested to see in her book how she then also kind of addresses that aspect of Christianity, particularly evangelical fundamentalism.
I was going to ask you exactly about that. I was going to ask you why you think evangelical Christianity often, not always obviously, but often does not prioritize climate action. Is it because there is so much focus on the afterlife and the world ahead, the relationship with God beyond this earth? Is it because of sort of a human-centric view of nature, or is it something else? What do you think?
Definitely, I've thought a lot about that, especially as a kid. You know, I think there's a lot of that in which it's just kind of like the prize is not here on earth. The prize is heaven, whatever happens here. There's a lot of narrative about, you know, it's punishment because our nation has turned away from Christ, you know, especially when it comes to like the book of Revelation and the last days. Every time a new climate crisis happens, it's just a newer confirmation, I think, for a lot of Christians that the end times are coming. You know, that was a big theme in my childhood. I used to have a lot of apocalyptic dreams because of it. is just the idea that, like, you know, you're not seeing as directly you being the hand of this destruction. It's God working through you. And if this is happening, then it's supposed to happen because maybe we've done something wrong. Maybe we need to repent as a nation. Maybe we need to repent as a world, you know, and that's not something for us to be worried about, quote unquote, for a lot of Christians, I imagine. That's been my perspective of it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. If you don't mind me asking, do you consider yourself, you know, what sort of religious affiliation do you consider yourself now?
I'm more of the agnostic bent these days,
yeah.
I would say. Yeah, definitely more agnostic. I'm not of the idea that there is not a higher power, there is not a God. You know, I've had a lot of amazing things, beautiful, miraculous things happen in my life. And, you know, I look around me, I do think that there is an agent there, a higher power. But I just think there's other paths of getting, I guess, to a quote-unquote heaven, you know? Yeah, that's how I feel.
How is your family with that?
We definitely have a lot of spirited conversations. you know, some have accepted, some have not. But, you know, I always try to put love at the forefront of those conversations. There was a time where, you know, fresh out of college, I was more spirited about those kinds of things. But now I, you know, we literally might not have a lot of time, you know what I mean? So I prioritize the love that I have for my family, first before anything. And even when we have those discussions of something, I try to keep in the back of my mind is that they just care about me and they love me a lot.
Sure. Oh, I can't imagine they don't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are their politics still pretty similar to when you were growing up?
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
And does that lead to some spirited debate too, or do you sort of let that go?
I try to at least the spirited debates. I try to let it go. Sometimes it crops up, you know. That's just the nature of having family, you know.
Talking to Xander Brown, a journalist based in Flint, Michigan, who attended the University of Rochester. And I have to be honest, you know, someone tipped us off to this story in the University Gazette and just was so impressed with Xander's work and who Xander is as a person and said, this is the kind of person whose story should be highlighted on Connections. And that's how this all came together. And I'm so glad we're talking. So you end up at University of Rochester. And as you say, you know, Flint is experiencing its water crisis. You're from the Flint area, but it still feels a little bit far removed for you. The chicken and egg kind of question I had in reading your story, I wondered if you ended up sort of migrating into environmental humanities because of Flint, or did you take some environmental humanities classes and then did you start to feel differently about what was happening there?
Yeah, it was definitely the courses first. Like, and I mean, I didn't even, because I think the title of the course is something like literature. It was something like kind of literature, the environment, and something else. It was something like very like unassuming to me. And I was like, oh, this is just another, like, course where I read a lot. Okay, dope. You know, it wasn't something I was like, oh, okay, yes, I would like to be more environmentally aligned, you know. But as I continued to sit in on the classes and my professor, Leila Nadir, who's also the head of that department now, she really engaged with me. And when I was taking those courses, I don't know how to explain my sense of academic proficiency. I didn't really think I had a lot to say, especially on the topic of environmentalism. And she was one of those people that really kind of gently prodded me and wanted to hear my thoughts in class and, you know, really engage with me, which got the gears turning in that direction onward.
How do you define what environmental humanities means?
So in my words, environmental humanities, it looks at what we imagine the environment to be and looking at that definition through the medium of books and literature, journalism, things that have been written, more kind of written definitions as opposed to more of like a scientific scope of like seeing how the environment works, why things exist the way they exist, ecologies. This is more kind of almost like, I would say, kind of the social science depth of how we as human beings relate to the concept of environment.
What came to mind for me in reading about this area of study, environmental humanities, which is a program that was established at the U of R in 2017, and our guest Xander Brown was one of the was in the first cohort of students, and as you mentioned, she ended up minoring in it. What came to mind for me was a debate that's been happening in this country, particularly since, for example, the proposal of the Green New Deal or related environmental proposals that sometimes are the debate sounds like this. Let's keep climate action on climate. Let's keep it on energy production. Why are we talking about minimum wage in climate action? Why are we talking about racial justice? Why are we talking about issues that some critics say are far afield from climate action in bills or programs or policies like the Green New Deal? The environmental humanities seems to be saying that ecological issues, environmental issues, go beyond where we maybe used to or traditionally thought of them, and they impact lives beyond them. And that's the debate that came to mind for me, is where does policy go in terms of energy? Are we going too far afield, or is it appropriate to go in those directions? How do you see it?
No, I think you kind of hit the nail right on the head there. Environmental humanities asks the question, what do we have to do with it, right? What do people have to do with it? And I think, you know, a large part of the environmental conversation tends to be about, you know, the ice caps are melting, or, you know, the polar bears are, you know, dimming in number, you know, such things, you know, extinct species. But it touches on kind of the critical question of how is it that the way we live, right, how is it the way that we run our society formulate these ideas of how we move forward in the world and how human beings are responsible for this climate change, right? So when, you know, you're talking to people about why they should care about the environment, you also have to contend with the pushback of, like, that person might not have time to consider how they can live more sustainably when they're worried about, you know, their children having food to eat, or, you know, whether they're going to make rent, or, you know, their housing situation. You know, there's this new kind of concept that I've been mulling over for a while now, and it's called, you know, disaster capitalism, of how disaster capitalism, you know, forces us to the extremes of literal survival, to the point where, you know, questions of environment and climate change get pushed back to our minds, you know what I mean? Because we can't really consider that when you're just thinking about how to get through the day to day. Why minimum wage is important? Because maybe if people weren't so concerned about not having enough money to live, then these conversations would seem more accessible. But conversations about, like, oh, conserving such and such, or the extinction is such and such, doesn't seem real to a person who's living on the edge of society, and you know, and is living in a means that, you know, is hard to contend with. So I think that's the question that environmental humanities ask the most. It's also cultural questions, right? Particularly bringing it back to my own experience. There's always been sustainable practices within even my household, even though we might not call it, you know, some of my family members might not call themselves, you know, environmentally conscious, but, you know, recycling, you know, plastic bags, repurposing, you know, different food containers. There are always, like, been sustainable practices that have been embedded in my culture as a Black American, you know, and even taking it back to when you consider culturally, how many Black people migrated from such an agricultural background, a sustainable, I mean, although painful, background to working in the factories, working in the shops, pushing a less sustainable, you know, trend in society. Those are the kind of things that environmental humanities can touch on. And, you know, specifically with me, how do I, as a Black American with a relatively, you know, agricultural backdrop, you know, return to that in a way that promotes sustainability, is more environmentally conscious, and, you know, brings us back away from kind of a capitalistic, you know, definition of progress, you know?
Yeah, what Xander just said about, especially about wages, inequality, people struggling with poverty. We've said on this program many times, and many guests have said, that it is very, very difficult to be thinking about climate action when you can't pay for groceries, when you can't figure out if you can make rent, when you don't have transportation to get to work. And so if we as a society want to be a little bit better mobilized to deal with these problems, it almost definitionally has to be a more egalitarian society. And a super inegalitarian society is very poorly positioned to deal with something like climate change. And I think what Xander Brown is saying is one of the clearest articulations of that, and maybe goes a long way to answering questions about why certain policies about climate include things like UBI or minimum wage, et cetera. It's just it's an interesting and it's a more holistic way to think about it. And that's part of where Xander's studies were at the University of Rochester. Mm-hmm. So I want to take a phone call because I want to move the discussion now into where your work has taken you, and in particular, how you sort of use that lens in Flint, back in Flint, Michigan, where you grew up and where you're now working. But this is Mary in Rochester. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Xander. I'm really enjoying this conversation, but the first thing that came to mind when I heard that you had the experience of Flint is that back in the 60s, mid-60s, the Urban League of Rochester was involved in a huge push to get legislation passed in the state government on lead abatement. And there was, because there was a huge problem of lead paint and most low-income people in Rochester at the time were not homeowners. They were renting from they were renters, and you know, the landlords weren't terribly responsible about removing or dealing with lead paint. But Dr. Anderson, David Anderson, also known as Sankofa, who you're probably familiar with, had a youth group put together a brochure. And I found it and took pictures of it because I couldn't remove it from the library collection, special collections, you know, the Rundell, not the Reese, U of R library. I forget what it's called.
Rush Reese,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you come across that by any chance?
I haven't actually. Sorry.
Oh, well, don't be sorry. I mean, I'd love to share it with you. I was doing a paper for a master's degree, and I came across it. And it's just an amazing piece of work by this youth group. They're just kids that were, I believe they were in Head Start or some summer program. It's like a summer youth program. And they put together this brochure, and there was something else I was going to say about it. But, are you familiar with Dr. Anderson?
You're saying Sankofa?
Yeah.
Oh, no, not really. Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't mean to...
it's okay, Mary.
On the spot, but, you know, it just... I know. I was going to say that youth group had a reunion a couple of years ago. They're all grown now. You know, they're in 40s and 50s by this time. So I just think it's an interesting bit of history of how a community can get involved in environmental issues. So
yeah, Mary, I appreciate that, because the subject of lead in Rochester has been one that's been a devastating one for a long time. There's been a lot of amazing people who have done work to bring us far more progress on this issue than we might otherwise have had. Just out of curiosity, Xander, I mean, we talk about lead in the water in Flint. how much do you think about, you know, lead and whether it's in paint, housing, et cetera, usually in this country, in urban parts of our country, in redlined parts of our country? How much is that still a concern?
Oh, yeah, I think I think it still is a major concern, even in places that haven't been spotlit in the same way that Flint has. That's something I definitely recognize while living in Rochester, is Rochester is kind of like a parallel industrial city as Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And it exists in Rochester, and I imagine it exists in a lot of industrial cities that have, you know, infrastructure, the pipes, you know, the buildings, the paint, you know, the plaster, whatever that might be, that is still kind of haunting a lot of people who might not be aware of it, or, you know, kids that, you know, with learning disabilities and stress on like the educational, you know, structures in those cities as well. So I thought about it a lot for sure. And I would even say that with my understanding of Flint, I learned it, I think, and became more sensitive to it while in Rochester because of that, by far.
Talking to Xander Brown, a journalist based in Flint, Michigan, who went to the University of Rochester and studied, among other subjects, environmental humanities, a program established in 2017. And Xander was in that first cohort of students. It became a minor of hers. And now doing the work back in her home region of Flint. When we come back from this only break of the hour, we're going to talk about what that work has been like in the last couple of years and where she would like to take it next, in Flint or elsewhere. I mean, Xander grew up in the Flint area, but in the suburbs, and now feels much more sort of in tune with the injustice there, the kind of injustice that governing bodies have examined and ruled and said this is sadly not a one-off, but this is due to decades of structural racism. So let's get that only break, and we'll come right back with Xander Brown. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, youth climate leaders are gearing up for the Green Games. It's an initiative where they'll challenge their peers across the Rochester Finger Lakes region to take action when it comes to combating climate change. They join us to talk about Meatless Mondays, fossil fuel divestment, an art challenge, and more. We'll talk about it Friday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Xander Brown, take us through your path post University of Rochester and graduation in 2018.
I am graduated by now after doing frantic applications. I didn't think I was going to go back home, or rather, I didn't want to go back home.
What did you want to do? What did you think you were going to be?
I was like, oh, NPR, you know what I mean? let me do The Atlantic, or, you know, the Chicago Tribune, with like little to no portfolio pieces whatsoever. I look back at those cover letters often. So I ended up doing some research. I'm like, what is going on back home? Like, what is it, something I can get involved in? And Flint Beat Newsroom was one of those places I first encountered. And as soon as I got back for that summer, I started working within that media organization and started doing things I'd never really done before, like riding on MTA buses and following people to grocery stores to take video clips, looking up data and statistics. I was just all gung-ho and ready to go and hit the ground running.
How much? Mm-hmm. How much of a mix of photography, videography, writing, et cetera?
Oh, I was doing it. I was doing it all. Yeah, I definitely. I want to say I'm a Jill of all trades, master of whatever matters. I think that's what I probably say.
I love that. And what's an example of the kind of story that you were telling that meant a lot to you?
Man, because I put so much into every story. I think the one that sticks out the most in my mind was there was a food desert story that I had worked on, and that was like the first like package story ever done. And it meant a lot to me because I really got to know what it felt to be on the ground talking to real people, you know, in the elements. It was raining. I was going to food pantries. I was in food pantry basements. Like I said, I'd never been on an empty bus like that extensively. I was among strangers. I was doing whatever needed to be done to tell that story. I felt in the fullest way possible. And I met so many people through that story that I still see walking down the street today. So that food desert story that I did for Flint Beat probably will be something I never really forget.
Well, and you ended up telling stories like this and becoming a journalist. You know, we've talked about the fact that you grew up thinking about a lot about reading, a love of reading, literature, maybe majoring in English or history or pursuing careers in that. And then you get into environmental humanities. But we haven't really talked about what really set you on that path to journalism. And you go back to 2016, there was, you know, just another, I mean, another, I hate to say another year in recent years in which there were national names that people still remember, probably Philando Castile in Minnesota, Alton Sterling, Louisiana. So there were Black Lives Matter demonstrations in downtown Rochester when you were here. And you said that you took your camera and just started sort of documenting what was going on. Take me through that experience and how it affected you.
Yeah. So again, like this is also during a period of time when I was going through my own shift ideologically, in which I just kind of got tired of taking for granted the things that people were saying about what was going on, you know, because I think during that time when those protests were going off, there were people that were annoyed that the protests were happening, that there was noise on campus. There were people that were super fired up about it. And I just got to the point where my curiosity kind of it overtook my fear of what it would mean for me to go. And so I think using my camera kind of as that leading portal, justifying my curiosity was super pivotal for me. And I just remember seeing and feeling so in touch with what was going on, not necessarily like because, you know, they're strangers, but I felt so embedded and so just present in that moment and vulnerable with the people that were there, and being able to take those images really meant a lot to me. I remember posting on Facebook about it and being like, you know, if you're ever curious about like what these things mean or like why these things are happening, and, you know, instead of posting about it, why don't you try to go? Like I went today, like I overcame my fear and I went and I investigated for myself what these protests were about and how people were really feeling and what emotional symbolism and, you know, everything, what that really meant.
When you say overcame
your... How I could relate to it.
Yeah, when you say overcame your fear, what were you afraid of?
I think what I mean, like overcoming... Okay, so I guess I'll be very honest. When you are a Black person, right, and what some might consider a palatable Black person with the way you talk, you know, you go to school, people call you Oreo and stuff like that, you get into this mindset of where you don't want to be that kind, right, of Black person, whatever the heck that might mean for some folks. Not too radical, you know. That was something I kind of went through in high school when people would say, you know, really racist things to me or in front of me and then tell me, well, you're not that kind of Black person, so we don't really have to worry about it. And being socially aware or participating in social justice demonstrations or even wanting to go or even wanting to see where you fit into the equation or, you know, it can get you labeled as like, oh, that person's a radical, or like you don't have like you're not rationally centered, like you're not really considering it for what it is. And I think that was one of the fears that I had, is like, oh, if I'm going to like history, or if I'm going into, you know, if I want to be a professor or whatever, like would I not be, you know, kind of condemning myself as somebody who's not a central, what do they call objective person, you know, by participating in these things or going to these things. So I think that was one of the fears that I was overcoming, especially as a person who had been conservative for most of their life. Do you get what I mean?
Very much so. I mean, what a what a powerful set of feelings to experience. And when you say that you were called Oreo in 2004, then state senator running for the Senate, Barack Obama, said that there has to be a change in mindset that a black kid with a book is acting white. Is that what the slur Oreo means to you?
Yeah, Oreo just means, like, mostly I think white people call me that as, like, I don't act black.
Oh, so like, white people use that term for you.
Yeah, that's why I was, I went to all white institutions and private institutions,
Wow.
I was called that, I was like, oh, you don't really act black, really. Like, you're white on the inside, like, the way that you talk, like, you're not really black at all. Like, you don't know any rap or anything like that, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
Things of that nature.
So you're confronting all of this. You go down to this event in 2016. It clearly moved you and set you on kind of a different course, not only in how you're thinking about the world, but in how you're thinking about your own career in journalism. And I am curious to know, Xander, not because I want to sort of spark any oppositional thoughts or whatever. I'm just curious to know if over time then, are you, you know, talking to your more conservative family about how they feel about BLM movement and protests, whether it's Philando Castile, Walter Scott? I mean, there's so many. And did you have conversations with your family about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I did. I still continue to this day. But I think one thing that I want to stress is that those conversations are not how they're pictured or how they're verbalized via Twitter or Facebook or, you know, spunk pieces talking about, like, oh, went to Thanksgiving with my conservative family and this was the hellscape that resulted. You know, that's not what those conversations consist of. That's not how I've had to experience having those conversations. Like, it's very much a lot of listening. It's very much even a lot of historical evaluation on my part, because I am talking to multiple generations of black people, you know, and I think that needs to be emphasized, because there's, even during, like, this past election cycle with, you know, President Biden talking about, like, you know, if you're not voting for this party, you know, you're not really a black person. You know, that was like a memo that, you know, resounded pretty harshly with people, is that, you know, black people are not a monolith. Black families are not a monolith. You know, and so all those conversations that people take for granted in this social justice landscape, compounded by social media, you know, they're only as real as you probably would imagine them to be in concept. In practice, those are completely different, you know. So, yes, I've definitely had to have those conversations, but they're not as pedantic and didn't as they started when I was fresh coming back from school and hot on the heels of books and philosophy and theory. You know, you really have to meet people where they're at, you know, no matter who they are.
You said that in your work in journalism now, you want to look beyond sort of just a surface level event or a headline, whether it's Flint's water crisis or other societal problems, because there's often so much that undergird those problems. How effective do you think journalism is generally at doing that? And how do you see your role in that going forward?
Generally, I would say journalism, I think its intentions are always with, you know, democracy, highlighting, you know, the darkness, all that. But a lot of it is just kind of like what gets the clicks, you know, which is why I've been very grateful to be part of a lot of independent journalism, you know, projects. Like, those newsrooms that I were a part of are not seen as quote unquote traditional media. Right. And, you know, whatever that means, because even that is falling apart and changing with time. I think that, you know, investigating it more abstractly, even, you know, with the water crisis, the way that it was covered, like very literally, and that, oh, these people are in crisis, these people are in crisis, these people are in crisis. And then, you know, after it seemed like the literal crisis has abated, what is left over? And I think that was kind of my role as a journalist and as a young reporter, is still bringing meaning and relevancy to what happens to people, you know, what are the things that they're celebrating? What are the things that they're involving their kids in? What are some of the community, you know, rallying that is still going on past the hype, you know? I think that is what humanizes journalism and journalistic storytelling, is that you don't stop after the gore and the crisis of the issue. And I think particularly when it comes to minority populations and Black people, there's already a silent alarm going off with, you know, these particular people being a symbol of like what injustice looks like. Like, this is what happens to people when the government fails and blah, 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 blah. And it goes deeper than that, and talking about how people are living their realities and how even that is, there's beauty in the ordinary, right? And I think with a lot of my coverage, like talking about environmental issues, talking about a woman whose simple act of cleaning up a park that a lot of people have fond memories of, that was getting grown over and people were throwing trash over into it, how her simple community revolutionary act of keeping and being the caretaker of that space was so popular amongst readers for that story, not just because it was this, you know, a woman cleaning up a park, but because of the memories and the generational memories of that place. That really meant a lot to me to cover stories like that. If that answers your question.
Yeah, very much so. How do you view your work in journalism vis-a-vis, you know, maybe the question of what is journalism, what is activism, and how hard should the line be?
Yeah, I've definitely thought a lot about that. Even have some relative discomfort, I think, even being called an activist or even an advocate for that matter.
Because you view yourself as a journalist first?
I do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. No, I do, yeah.
Yeah, I do. Because I think what I prefer is to let the reality speak for themselves. And I think that's the merit of doing a good job as a journalist, is that you're doing the proper curation and the proper searching for those voices and those realities that once captured. That's why I love multimedia storytelling. That's why I love photography, because that is what it is, words or not. Like once you've seen something, once you've heard somebody say a reality in the way that they understand it, that is what it is, you know? And as a journalist, you do your best to do the backgrounding necessary to bed those voices and those perspectives in a way so that the reader or whoever's watching can really understand the impact. But that's what I prefer. You know, I do enjoy, I guess, you know, I have strong feelings. I'm a very passionate person defaultily. And I think that's why I kind of enjoy sitting back and leaving space for those people that I find and those stories that I find to speak even deeper to the things that I only feel. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Because when I was at university and my friends were telling me that, I could only feel, right? I could only feel what, you know, the hurt and the pain and the confusion, even marginally. But the people that were there, the people that have those voices, the people that live in those homes with those pipes that have not been replaced, those are the gems, you know what I mean? And that is the source that should be respected. And I enjoy putting myself in the position to simply be a medium by which those things can be spoken and realized.
I think that that's a phenomenally wise understanding of the difference between journalism and activism, and I admire it. Let me ask you, before we lose the hour, what's happening now in Flint? I mean, people kind of still wonder from afar, what's the situation with the water? Are things better, for lack of a better word? Is there justice? What's happening now?
Well, I think some are still waiting to get their pipes replaced, as far as I know. And in terms of the news, there's been a lot of outcropping of stories about people that are simply, you know, being told what ways can they justify, you know, with the lawsuits going on, having, you know, money sent their way. Like, how can people prove that they were affected? You know, there was a recent story about how There was a period where people were getting, you know, tested to see if there was lead in their system with these kind of like handheld like X-ray devices or something of which to see if there was lead present in their bones. And now there was an issue with, you know, the fact that maybe people hadn't been disclosed to the full risks of participating in those particular tests. And if the validity of those tests need to be implemented or completely thrown out. So that, I think that's kind of where people are at right now. It's definitely not in terms of any frenzy right now about the water. People are just going from day to day, but there is this kind of overhead of like what those lawsuits mean and what does it really mean to prove that you are affected by something that is a natural need that you definitely imbibed at one point in time. So
where is your work now? Where can people find your work?
Okay, so right now I'm actually a reporting fellow with the Daily Yonder. So the Daily Yonder is a national publication that specifically focuses on rural issues in rural America. And so you can find me there at the Daily Yonder, and I'll be working on developing my multimedia agro-environmental beat. So,
Xander Brown, a journalist, and if there is any justice, we're all going to be working for you someday, Xander. You can put that right on the resume. Listen, I do appreciate you being generous with your time and talking to, you know, your old town back in Rochester. It's great to hear your voice, and thanks for the work that you're doing, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Xander Brown, a 2018 U of R grad, and now doing such interesting work. Isn't that an amazing hour there? Thanks to all the folks who reached out, by the way, and prompted us to get in touch. Our thanks to the whole team here at Connections. MRA Stein, Megan Mack, Rob Braden, Evan Dawson, Barsook Records, and Rah Rah Riot for the music. And thank you for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.